So I'd like to thank Zvi for making up such a nice title for me. Although, as you'll see, my talk is going to be of a perhaps rather a different character than one might have expected from the title. perhaps uncharacteristically. Calling it a countdown to new physics, partially because thinking about this talk has refocused my own thinking about what to be spending my physics time doing. I've spent the past year or so on holiday from weak scale physics, thinking about cosmology, inflation, changing gravity at long distances, and so on, which is a lot of fun. And then you think about what you're going to tell a group of serious people who are indispensable for the future of our field, and you start thinking rather more sober thoughts. Okay. So I don't have to tell you that we are likely on the threshold of a new golden era in experimental particle physics. And now, I entered graduate school in 1993, just as the SSC was canceled. Okay. And this whole time, you know, I sort of figured, okay, I'll have new data in my 30s, I'll have new data in my 30s, I'll have new data in my 30s. And it seemed like a sort of translationally invariant thing. That great things were always going to happen in some future long time away. It's a little bit like in string theory. Everything's going to be figured out in 50 years, you know, safely far away from when you're alive. Five. Oh, great. That's much better. So anyway, so 50, 10, 15, it's all the same thing. Now, to an academic, the relevant point is that all of a sudden, this year, at least when the LHC is supposed to come on, has for the first time become smaller than the number of years it will take a graduate student working with me to get their PhD. So this lucky bastard is going to have data before he graduates, or she graduates. And so this is, of course, very exciting, and has now come in to the timescale of academic generations. So given this, given the fact that we have, data from the Tevatron would be lovely.
Would be lovely.
Yeah, would be lovely. I'm sorry. All right. So I just want to take a second and just take a peek back at the last great era in our field, the late '60s and mid '70s. Of course, I wasn't there, but. Certainly, from looking at the history, it's very easy to conclude that back then there was a really marked difference in the relation between theory and experiment. In fact, it can sort of be characterized by a big difference in slope between then and now. Back then, people began in the mid-60s in, quote-unquote, total confusion. Murray Gell-Mann explained lots of things about quarks and quantum numbers, but dynamics was in complete chaos. 10 years later, the Standard Model was developed and understood to the point where it made specific predictions that were then confirmed experimentally. Okay. So just to give two examples, we had asymptotic freedom that predicted specific logarithmic deviations from scaling. It predicted gluons. These were things that were found with well-defined properties that you could predict ahead of time. And we predicted the W and Z masses were predicted and found exactly where they were supposed to be. Okay, so by contrast, since the Standard Model got established 25 years ago, we don't remotely have, in the intervening period, comparably sharp predictions for physics at the TEV scale. We were never in a state of as much confusion, I suppose, but we could also be sort of always wrong and never in doubt. I mean, So things didn't evolve very much for a long time, and there have been a few new ideas in the last 5-6 years or so, after the initial burst of ideas around 20 years ago. But the character of predictions we make now is very different than the character of the predictions in the previous generation. For example, we talk about supersymmetry somewhere near the GeV scale. This is not like MW equals 80 GeV, okay? We talk about new strong dynamics somewhere near the GeV scale. R is going to have some funny bumps and resonances, but we can't say exactly what. Or maybe we have low-scale gravity, we live on a brain, gravity becomes strong in a bulk somewhere near the GeV scale. So why is it that these guys back then made such sharp predictions, and we're sort of making these qualitative guides for what we're going to see? Now, the first reason that springs to mind is that we suck. that me and my advisors, also a generation of theorists, just suck relative to the intellectual giants that were the architects of the Standard Model. And, you know, I spend around a day, week, having lunch with Shelley. And, you know, he doesn't say it in as so many words, but that's sort of how I think he feels, okay? We just suck, all right? Could be. I don't know, what do you think, David? No comment. Thanks a lot. But perhaps more charitably, the big difference is, and I'm going through this because it's actually going to be relevant for what's going to be the main theme of my talk. More charitably, it could be because we have had no direct clues from experiment for what's going on at the TEV scale. Let me contrast the situation to what was going on in the late 50s, early 60s. Okay, we had QED, and we had also seen the weak interactions, and there are the strong interactions. Okay. Now, in a modern language, we had a nice renormalizable theory at low energies. We had some strong stuff we didn't understand. Let's come back to that in a second. But we had seen these weak interactions, and the only reason we saw them, they're a higher dimension operator in this effective low energy theory of QED with charged leptons and neutrinos. There's no reason why we should have hoped to see these small interactions coming from high scales, except for the fact that they violated a symmetry of the low energy theory, namely individual conservation of electron number, muon number, neutrino number, and electron and muon neutrino number. Okay? So there was some very weak interaction, which we could nevertheless see because it violated a symmetry of the low energy theory. And so despite the fact that we didn't have accelerators that probed anywhere near 1 over G Fermi, we had some indirect evidence, and after it became clear that it was VA rather than ST, and we knew just from low energy experiments the structure of these four fermion coupling, we had a powerful set of guides for what was going on at this high scale. Now, with the strong interactions, it was more complicated. The interactions were strong, but what started happening is that experiments started going above the GeV scale and seeing free partons, which suggested asymptotic freedom, and off we went. So, in the sort of language of energy scales, we were stuck down here in the 50s and 60s. There are two other important energy scales in nature that we didn't know about, lambda QCD and the W and the Z masses. But we got to know about them. One of them we got to know about partially directly just by experiment, by going to higher energies. The other one, fortunately, we had direct evidence for from the weak interactions that we saw because they violated symmetries of the low energy effective theory. Okay? So we had direct evidence for what the physics was. We didn't see it. We didn't see the whole W. We hadn't made it. But we had evidence that there was something beyond the low energy effective theory of QED, plus the complicated low energy strong interactions. So we had more clues. The experimental picture today is very different. We have an effective theory at low energies that we can parametrize now as a standard model Lagrangian, plus a whole bunch of higher dimension operators. We can just parametrize them as higher dimension operators suppressed by some scale lambda, we don't know what it is. And the problem is that unlike back then, we have seen no evidence for these. We have neither gone to high enough energies to see something new, as in the strong interactions, nor do we have any indirect evidence for something coming from higher energies, as in the weak interactions. Okay. Yeah, so I had that somewhere. Oh, sorry, I had that in my notes, except for neutrino masses. But, okay. The neutrino masses are not so dynamically interesting, but we can, anyway. I don't want to get into a fight. All right. So in sharpest contrast with the previous era, we have no evidence for effects that violate low energy symmetries. Oh, here it is, except neutrino masses. Okay. So in particular, the operators that violate baryon number, for example, QQQL, suppressed by high scale, has to be suppressed by at least 10 to the 15th GeV. Operators that violate flavor, such that operators that give us delta MK, epsilon K, mu to E gamma, and so on, have to be violated, have to be suppressed by 100 to 1,000 TeV. We've seen no evidence for them, and we can put limits, and the limits are significantly above the TeV scale, way above the TeV scale. And furthermore, so what about other operators, things that don't violate low energy symmetries? Well, LEP was supposed to be a wonderful discovery machine. Alas, it didn't discover anything. But it did do something extremely useful, which is to put very tight bounds on just normal operators that don't violate any standard model symmetries. Okay. So the precision electric measurements first suggest the light Higgs with a mass less than around 200 GeV, and secondly, constrain many of the operators that don't even violate the standard model symmetries. Here's a list of them. Here's just a bunch of dimension 6 operators involving the Higgs and the gauge fields, the Higgs itself, the coupling of the Higgs to the leptons, and so on. This one gives rise to the S parameter, and that scale is constrained to be bigger than 10 TeV. This is the T parameter, the rho parameter, constrained to be more than 5 to 6 TeV. These kind of operators shift the couplings of the light fermions at the z-pole, or have to be suppressed by scales more than 7 to 9 TeV. And typically, the limits on these operators are between 5 and 10 TeV. So not only have we not seen any evidence for new physics at the TeV scale, even indirectly, the limits we have are starting to get significantly better than the TeV scale. Okay. So we have no reason, direct reason, to believe there's anything at the TeV scale, experimentally. In the absence of direct experimental hints, of course, what we've done is relied on theoretical guides. And there are lots of things that you could try to explain in the standard model, the pattern of fermion masses, neutrino masses, and so on, but the best scientific questions are characterized, have the characteristic that their answers give you significantly more than the answer to the question that you asked to begin with. And what seems to have that character more than any of the other problems in the standard model is the hierarchy problem. Why is the Higgs mass, why is the weak scale small compared to other scales in nature? If we just look at the quantum correction to the mass of the Higgs from a top loop, then it turns out to be around 200 GeV squared, normalizing in terms of 200 GeV, just that's sort of preferred light Higgs mass, and times the cutoff over 700 GeV all squared. So this is clearly a Greek spelling of ridiculous for a lambda of order M Planck. And so from here we conclude that for this not to be ridiculous, we have to have lambda less than around a TeV. Right? So new physics at the TeV scale. And of course, this is the heart of the squishiness of everything we do. Okay? We don't know what that means. 1 TeV, 10 TeV. All right. But still, it sure seems like that something should explain this enormous hierarchy between the weak and the Planck scales, and we haven't been lazy. There's many possible solutions that we've talked about already. The best one is still low energy supersymmetry. Top loops are canceled by stop loops. Roughly, we say m-stop should be less than a TeV. And with super partners in the desert, we get gauge coupling unification around a percent prediction. Spectacular. A recent addition to the set of theories that are weakly coupled at the TeV scale are the little Higgs models that are theories where the Higgs is understood to be light because it's a pseudo-Goldstone boson. So this is a very old and very sort of obvious idea that has recently been made to work. And what happens here is that this top loop is canceled not by some stop, some particle of opposite statistics, but actually by some heavy copies of the top itself. Partners of the same statistics cancel the quadratic divergences. We'll talk about it in a bit later. And again, roughly you expect these guys to be lighter than a TeV. And the typical picture for these theories is that you have the Higgs and the W and the Z, they're around 100 GeV. At around the TeV scale, we have partners of the top, partners of the W and Z, partners of the Higgs. And then at around 10 TeV, these theories are all theories of, they're theories of Goldstone bosons. The Goldstone boson interactions become strong at around 10 TeV. And up here, you have to embed them into a theory that makes sense deep into the ultraviolet. When we first wrote these theories down, we were mostly concerned with making predictions for what we might see at the TeV scale and weren't thinking about building ultraviolet completions. But as good model builders, we know how. And UV completions, concrete ultraviolet completions in terms of theories with strong dynamics above a TeV scale have recently started to be constructed. So if you want the theory to make sense all the way up to the Planck scale, you can think that there's some theory of strong dynamics that goes through a strainer, and out of the strainer pops an unusually light pseudo-Goldstone boson. That's lighter than you would have thought because of a symmetry reason we'll discuss. But at any rate, all the strong dynamics is happening at 10 TeV. The theory at the TeV scale is perfectly perturbative. So that's one set of possibilities, perturbative physics at the TeV scale. And of course, another qualitative kind of possibility is strongly coupled physics at the TeV scale. First example being Technicolor. And also theories of low scale gravity with larger warp dimensions are also examples of strong coupling at the TeV scale. Roughly speaking, strong coupling at the TeV scale means that you don't draw a diagram that cancels a quadratic divergence. Okay? You just say things are fluffy, big, strongly coupled. Okay? If you can't draw a diagram to cancel the quadratic divergence, it's strongly coupled at the TeV scale. And in fact, the theories of warp dimensions have a dual interpretation as a sort of Technicolor theory in four dimensions. So these ideas are not all completely independent. Okay, so this is a review. You guys all know this. This is all terrific at the broad brush order of magnitude level. Things are near the TeV scale. Here are all these different possibilities. But what I'd like to emphasize is something that's been known for a while, but I think more and more people are starting to worry about. And I think they're starting to worry about partially because in a few years, we're not goofing off anymore, and we're going to have to really explain things. There seems to be, in detail, a tension between having a natural theory, one where the Higgs is naturally at 200 GeV, and one that's consistent with the test from precision electro weak tests. And the reason is simply that, remember, on the one hand, for naturalness, let's say I don't want to allow more than a 10% tuning for the Higgs mass, then the cutoff just from the top loop has to be around 2 TeV. Right? On the other hand, the precision electro weak data seem to be suggesting that nothing is happening until 5 to 10 TeV. So everything I'm now going to be talking about is this roughly factor of 5 to 10 discrepancy between the scale at which we know the Higgs has to be modified near the TeV scale and the scale at which we know things are not modified somewhat above the TeV scale by maybe a factor of 5 or 10. If we just allow, if we just push this lambda up to 5 to 10 TeV, then we're talking about tuning at the percent to 10 to the minus 3 level. Okay. So this is called the little hierarchy problem. And it's really the legacy of LEP. LEP didn't discover any new physics, but it did the best it could, and this is the problem it leaves us with. This is a hierarchy problem that has nothing to do with any theoretical prejudices about where the Planck scale is, or short distance physics, or anything. It simply has to do with the fact that experimentally, we have a lot of evidence now, virtually, that nothing new is happening until 10 TeV, but something new must happen at 1 TeV for naturalness, for the Higgs mass. That's the tension. So what should we make of this? Okay. There's two attitudes. Attitude one is, give me a break. It's only a factor of 10. Maybe you square it in the tuning, but come on, it's a factor of 10. This is nothing compared to the big hierarchy problem. So, and anyway, accidents happen. We have the examples that I've mentioned and many people have mentioned before. The Earth eclipses the Moon. That's around a percent accident. The nuclear, a little more directly, binding energy in nuclei. The deuteron has a binding energy of 2 MeV. Where did 2 MeV come from? All the mass scales in nuclear physics are 135 MeV, the pion mass at best. Where did 2 MeV come from? The best understanding of nuclear physics is, oh, it's about a percent cancellation between the potential and kinetic energies in the deuteron bound state. Okay, just happens. And Yuval Grossman just told me this one the other day. It's great. The B meson mass in MeV is the number of feet in a mile to three decimal places. So the King of England knew something about CP violation. Right? So if you're gonna, so many people have told me that to sort of obsess about this is to be a picky, unambitious loser. Okay, and I should stop doing that. All right, but there's a second attitude that we can take, obviously, which is to take it as a serious hint that and a constraint on what we should be thinking about. And as we'll see, it's actually very challenging to build theories that solve this little hierarchy problem. And since this problem really directly has to do with the structure of the theory at the TeV scale, if we take this problem seriously, whatever its solutions are going to have some important impact on what sort of physics we might expect to see at the TeV scale. And at least in the examples I'm going to discuss today, there are a number of general features and lessons that we're going to be able to take away. But just as a defense against this, why are you worrying about a factor of 5 I'm going to appeal to greater authority, namely Nambu. Right? Back in the early 60s, we could have known that there's a lot of weird hadrons. There's the pion, there's the rho, there's the proton, of course. And the ratio of the mass of the pion to the mass of the rho is only a factor of 5. Oh, big deal. Pion's just another hadron. Factor of 5. There's nothing particularly special about it. Why would anyone make a big deal about that factor of 5? It's just some accident. We don't understand hadronic dynamics. Okay. But this, as we know, was wrong.
That came after.
Sorry.
Other successive experiments.
What came after other?
Thinking of the pion. Didn't start. Just
that, this is when? This is 58 or something?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, one could have taken this attitude. Okay. But this is clearly wrong if we take this seriously, as Nambu did, and now take an important step, and I think this was an important step, to imagine a different world, not our world, but a different world where this 5 is in fact parametrically small, not just numerically small, but parametrically small. In fact, imagine a limit where this ratio is 0, that you look at the data, you see some trend, and then imagine in your mind taking a limit of that trend where you make it bigger, and try to explain that. Okay. And that's the right thing to do. The fact that in the real world it's just a factor of 5 smaller is really a complete accident. And 5 1/5 isn't particularly small, but when you have the right parametric idea, at least very often in the history of physics, things happen to work out numerically pretty well too. Okay, so we have many examples. So if you're going to take this attitude too towards the little hierarchy problem, I really want to imagine it very much the same. Okay, we're seeing a sort of vague hint in the data. Let's now imagine stretching it out. Let's make it a real problem, and then try to find a real solution to it. Okay. So we appear to see a hint of something in the data. The hint is that we appear to have evidence for a Higgs that's pretty much the same mass as the W and the Z. And we've measured electroweak corrections to around the one loop level, and things agree with the standard model. So let's take that. Let's now imagine a world where all the standard model couplings are a lot smaller. Okay, so we can separate scales more, but still insist that we have the same qualitative physics. Okay, we're going to have the Higgs is going to be the same mass as the W and the Z. Corrections are going to be of order. The corrections are going to be smaller than the percent level. And this is the sort of picture it suggests. Picture it suggests is, for example, we can have the Higgs and the W and the Z all at around GV. G is some small coupling. Okay. We have the scale 4 pi V. And up here, we can have some new physics. So these guys are one loop factor beneath that scale. And we can imagine having weak new physics above there. Alternately, this is just pretty much the same thing. I'm rewriting it a different way. I don't have to commit to having weak physics all the way up. I can have the same thing. The Higgs is one loop factor beneath this guy, which is in turn one loop factor beneath a scale where everything gets strong. Okay? So can we find theories that naturally produce this pattern? So it seems obvious that supersymmetry does this, and maybe we can come up with other theories that do that. And so in that sense, everything seems fine. But now let's talk about the little hierarchy problem in the context of supersymmetry. And we start running into problems. The first problem is that the Higgs in supersymmetry is not a particularly special scalar. Okay. The Higgs is just one of all the 120 scalars in the MSSM. And so there's no reason to expect it to be particularly lighter than anything else. So if the Higgs is supposed to be at the same scale as the W and the Z, then you would expect parametrically that all the rest of the squarks and sleptons should be at the scale of the W and the Z. Parametrically now. Okay? And it's important to make this parametric because then the actual difference between the actual difference is a factor of 5, but let's stretch it out. Let's stretch it out a lot. And so that would say, if we've seen the W and the Z, why haven't we seen the superpartners? This was, after all, the argument why we expected to see the W and the Z. Why we expected to see superpartners at LEP. And from the top down, even if you don't start with MH squared comparable to everything else, you radiatively generate corrections to the Higgs mass that are proportional to the superpartner masses times a loop factor, but a logarithm. And if you run from a high scale, this is an order 100% effect parametrically, again. Okay, this is the same thing that makes gauge couplings unify. So the loop factor times the log is parametrically of order 1. So typically, by the time you have the superpartners heavy enough to have escaped detection, that implies an M Higgs squared, which is too big. And this, again, typically implies around a 1 to 5% tuning on your model. So I traced this plot by something done by Alessandro Strumio, which I think very nicely illustrates this point. Let's take one of our garden variety favorite supersymmetric theories with universal boundary conditions at a high scale, near the gut scale. All right? You do a scatter plot. You arrange, you just, I hate this kind of plot, but you do it. You just range over all possible parameters. And typically, the most constraining things are to actually get the charginos heavy enough and the Higgs heavy enough to escape detection. And this is the sort of thing you get. So the vast majority of points in the scatter plot fall in a kind of in this red area. Okay. And the area down here was excluded by LEP 1. Okay. So okay, that's some order 1 fraction of the parameter space was excluded by LEP 1. But now LEP 2 has further excluded this, so that we're really left with a very small region, which is in this theory, what used to be one of our favorite theories that we talked about all the time, which is compatible just with experiment. Okay. So in fact, less than 1% of the region has heavy enough charginos and Higgs to be compatible with experiment. This plot actually reflects also a purely bottom-up part of the problem that doesn't that's sort of independent of the particular way that you run things down from a high scale, which has to do with the fact that the Higgs is heavier than we expected in supersymmetry again. Remember, in the supersymmetric limit, the Higgs quartic couplings are determined by the gauge couplings, and there's a tree-level relation that the Higgs mass is smaller than the Z mass. And of course, people have talked about evading this. There's no problem evading it, because supersymmetry is broken. Great. So supersymmetry is broken. Beneath the mass scale of the stops, for example, we have a non-supersymmetric theory, and there is no reason not to generate a quartic coupling for the Higgs from top loops in the effective theory beneath the mass of the stop. Okay, so there are some diagrams there. And of course, this is just some new logarithmic running of lambda. Lambda no longer has to track g squared, supersymmetry is broken, so we get a correction to the quartic coupling that's lambda top to the fourth, log, and for the usual reasons involving tops, threes come in, topical couplings are particularly small, the log can be a little big, and this effect can start becoming important and can start making the Higgs heavier. But this effect makes the Higgs heavier logarithmically with m stop. The trouble is that exactly the same diagrams stripping off two Higgses give you the usual quadratic divergence for the Higgs mass, which is not being canceled anymore. This tuning now grows quadratically with m stop. So if you want to make the Higgs heavier and heavier, you logarithmically win by making the quartic coupling bigger at the expense of quadratically losing in the fine tuning. And a rough rule of thumb, we're tuning a log versus the quadratic, a rough rule of thumb for an m Higgs of around 114 GeV is that the tuning doubling time is around 7 GeV. Okay? So for every 7 GeV you want to make the Higgs heavier, you pay another factor of 2 in the tuning. Okay. Now, does this mean supersymmetry is wrong? Of course not. We don't even have to take this problem seriously. As we said, maybe things are tuned. Maybe it is some totally vanilla variety of supersymmetry. Maybe we live in that corner, and that's fine. But if we're going to take this problem seriously, then something has to give. And this motivates two things that you can do. One thing you can motivate is say, look, this simplest version of supersymmetry now has this problem at the sort of percent level. So this motivates looking for alternatives that address the little hierarchy problem without a percent tuning. Another one is, look, gauge coupling unification is wonderful. All these things about supersymmetry are fantastic. It solves the big hierarchy problem. But we have to somehow change the structure of the theory at the TEB scale in order to address the little hierarchy problem. OK. And of course, this is the first thing one should do. But what I want to emphasize is that if we're going to deal with this problem, it's not a question of coming up with some new physics at very high energies to sort of twiddle things around a little bit and explain why some parameters have the values they do at low energies. Okay? In this sense, I view this problem as more serious and much more interesting than the supersymmetric flavor problem that people spent a long time obsessing about in the mid-90s. The Susie flavor problem has to do with, well, if the squark and slepton masses are random and have random flavor structure, we get unacceptable flavor changing neutral currents at low energies. But that was always an ultraviolet problem, in the sense that I could just say, if at low energies, all the squark and slepton masses are the same. I don't know where it came from, they're just the same. There's there was no problem. I then just had to invent an ultraviolet theory that arranged that for me in a nice way. It didn't in itself have immediate implications for the structure of the theory at the TEV scale. I think this problem does have implications for the structure of the theory at the TEV scale. All right. And of course, if we're going to mess with supersymmetry to solve this problem, the one thing we don't want to screw up is gauge coupling unification. That's the one hint we have that this is right. The one hint we have that supersymmetry is right. If we didn't have gauge coupling unification, I would not be thinking about low energy supersymmetry at all. Okay? So I don't want to mess up with gauge coupling unification. And I want to say that as of today, I think this is an open challenge. I don't think there is a model written down in the literature that convincingly, in a supersymmetric context, addresses the little hierarchy problem in a way that preserves gauge coupling unification. And I think this is a direction that's worth exploring because it'll have significant collider implications, as I said. All right, let me give you a couple of examples. What can we do? Well, we're trying to... The bottom-up problem we had to do with the fact that in the MSSM, the Higgs just started off life lighter than the Z, and that in order to change that, we have to break supersymmetry and fight a log against the quadratic divergence. Okay? So if we can just start with something that gets the Higgs heavier, then we'd be happy. So we can imagine jacking up the Higgs quartic coupling by additional F terms or D terms. Of course, these are old ideas. The first one's a very old idea. The next minimal supersymmetric standard model just adds a singlet to the supersymmetric standard model. This sort of Yukawa coupling and the superpotential clearly gives an additional contribution to the quartic potential that goes like H up H down to the fourth and increases the Higgs mass. The problem is that this coupling isn't asymptotically free, and it hits a Landau pole. So by the time you arrange that the Landau pole, so if it hits a Landau pole beneath the gut scale, then we have no reason to believe that unification will work. Okay. Now, in particular, nothing stops us from imagining that this theory is embedded into something sensible above the Landau pole scale. We have lots of examples of that in supersymmetric theories. But the Higgses would have to be composites now of whatever the prions in that upstairs theory are. And it's the Higgs quantum numbers that play the most crucial role in gauge coupling unification. Okay. There's things that don't come in complete multiplets of SU5 are the whole story for gauge coupling unification. And so there's simply no reason other than accident for the ultraviolet beta functions to agree with the infrared beta functions. And by the time you arrange that the Landau pole is above the gut scale, this coupling at the TEV scale is so small that it doesn't buy much for you. It lets you push the Higgs mass up maybe at most at 200 GeV, and it does not help the little hierarchy problem. Relatively newer ideas to use D terms. So you could imagine having the Higgses charged under some new gauge group. This gives a correction to the quartic coupling of order G squared, and you can play with that. But now again, unification is just not there manifestly. You can always arrange it. You always have a theory. You add some stuff. You add other things to cancel it. But you're left with wondering why the MSSM seemed to work. Okay? We don't want unification to be an accident. Okay, so I want to just outline some ideas that might work, and these are some things that discussing with a variety of people. There's actually simpler versions of this, but I just wanted to present something. Here's a theory that preserves unification. In fact, unifies just like the MSSM unifies. The scale of unification turns out to be very different. But the fact that you have unification is just for the identical reason that you had it in the MSSM. It's not an accident this theory unifies. And here's the picture. We have double the MSSM. So we have two 3-2-1 gauge groups. We have the MSSM quantum numbers. One of these gauge groups doesn't have the families and the other one does. But they all have the Higgses. Okay. And I'm going to spontaneously break these two gauge symmetries down to the diagonal subgroup by a field phi, which transforms as a bifundamental under the global SU5 symmetries into which I can embed the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. Okay, so everything, so unification is just manifest. So phi is going to get a BEV of this form and break things down. So this is double the MSSM, but it unifies for exactly the same reason as the MSSM, although at a lower scale. The diagonal gauge couplings are the sum of the gauge coupling for this guy and that guy. This gauge coupling runs from a high scale according to the MSSM beta function. So does the other one. But this diagonal one, then, when I add them up, looks as if it started off with this value, but it looks as if it was running with twice the beta function. Okay. So the couplings still unify exactly the same as before. However, the scale of unification is lower. It's not an accident that they unify. The scale is lower. Unification scale is actually 10 to the 8 to EV. But now we can have additional F terms that link. Now this is a 4 Higgs doublet theory. Okay, we've doubled the MSSM, so there's additional F terms that link the Higgses on one side and the other. These couplings can now be asymptotically free. We can raise the Higgs mass, in fact, as much as we want. And we can also raise the superpartner masses, so there's no tuning here. Okay? But this comes at a price that there's no tuning, but it's at the price of making everything heavier. And this is going to be a little generic, as you're going to see. Sorry? TeV, I'm sorry. 10 to the 8 TeV is the gut scale in this theory. And in fact, you might say, but don't we know the Higgs is light? Well, at least roughly, the same couplings in this model that allow you to make the Higgs heavy to begin with also allow you to be consistent with position electroweak data. Roughly speaking, in the ST plane, the usual problem with the heavy Higgs is that you make a more and more negative contribution to T as you go out to further and further positive S. But it's exactly these Yukawa couplings that are allowing us to make the Higgs heavier to begin with, and precisely these couplings also make a positive contribution to T. So roughly speaking, you move out along the long axis of this ellipse and stay consistent with position electroweak data, at least over some ranges of parameter space. All right, so this is just an outline. It's not a full model, but it's an example of a theory. We're taking supersymmetry little hierarchy problems seriously, and attempting to preserve unification leads to, in fact, a sort of dramatic alteration of the weak scale physics. We're not giving up supersymmetry and all those wonderful things for solving the hierarchy problem and everything else. None of this is radical, okay? So this is sort of, you know, 15 minutes of thought model building, okay? But what it predicts for the TeV scale is rather different. We have two copies of the MSSM, and everything is heavier. Okay. So much for supersymmetric attempts. And as I said, I think this is something that's really worth doing. And a few people have started thinking about this. The Europeans have been harping on the little hierarchy problem for a long time, but I think model builders have not been taking it as seriously as they should be, I think. All right. So here's another attempt to talk about, to address the little hierarchy problem now in a different way. And that is with the little Higgs, where the idea is that the Higgs is light because it's a pseudo-Goldstone boson. Okay, so this is a very old idea that goes back to Georgi and Pice in the mid-70s. And the trouble was, for a long time, that the Higgs looks nothing like a pseudo-Goldstone boson. It has all these big, hard, non-derivative couplings to top quark, W's, everything. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so we draw the usual loops, and we get a quadratic divergence, very much like the charged pion in QCD picks up a quadratic divergence from a photon loop, and this is part of the mass difference between the charged and neutral pions in QCD. Okay? If we had this picture for the Higgs, it would be true that we would understand why the Higgs is light compared to the TeV scale, because it's a pseudo-Goldstone boson, but the interactions, again, there's no Feynman diagram cutting off the quadratic divergence. It's strong coupling at the TeV scale. So Georgi and Kaplan in the mid-80s tried this again, and this was what they ran into. All right, so we now know how to get around that problem, and let me just quickly go through this. If we just go back and understand the pion example a little bit better, the pions are describing the spontaneous breaking of an SUN left cross SUN, right chiral symmetry down to the diagonal subgroup. And imagine for the moment that we weakly gauge this diagonal subgroup with a small gauge coupling G sub diagonal. In the limit where I turn off the gauge coupling, I have the full SUN cross SUN symmetry. There's a Goldstone boson U, and it transforms with a different left and right transformation under the SUN cross SUN symmetry, which I can represent diagrammatically as these two circles representing the global symmetry and an arrow connecting them. This tells me that it's an L on this side because the arrow is going out, and it's an R dagger on that side because the arrow is going in. But when I turn on the non-zero gauge coupling, the symmetry is explicitly broken down to the diagonal subgroup. And so you can think of what you're doing is taking this picture with the two circles, and now you're gluing the circles together into a red dot. Right? That's the real symmetry of the theory, and all I have is a Goldstone boson now, which is an adjoint under this SUN diagonal. There's no mercy. The mass is just one loop vector down beneath the cutoff. However, the new idea is that we can have a collective symmetry breaking so that we have not just one coupling, but that we have many symmetries that guarantee that the Higgs is a Goldstone boson. And any one interaction in the theory only breaks some of the symmetries. So that if you only ever had one interaction that breaks one of the symmetries that's keeping the Higgs a Goldstone boson, there's some other symmetry that's left that's still making the Higgs a Goldstone. Only when you have two of them do you know that the Higgs is not a Goldstone boson. Okay, and this allows you to need, so this forces you to have all the couplings to get a ultraviolet sensitive correction to the Higgs mass, and you can push up the quadratic divergences to two loops or higher, although the higher doesn't buy you much because you have a finite one loop piece that you can never get rid of. So here's a simple example. If we do a very similar picture again, except now I have a G1 and a G2, and I have two sets of Goldstone fields, U1 and U2, then one combination of these Goldstones is eaten and spontaneously breaks this gauged SUN1 cross SUN2 symmetry down to the diagonal subgroup. Another combination of the Goldstones is uneaten, so the tree-level spectrum of this theory is a heavy, massive gauge field and a massless gauge field and the uneaten Goldstone boson. So you would wonder, okay, let's draw the usual terrible loops. Does this Goldstone pick up a quadratically divergent mass just like the charged pion? And the answer is no. And you can understand from a symmetry reason why the answer is no. Because in the limit, as I take any one of these couplings to zero, remember what happens is that this then breaks apart into the two green circles, and I've enhanced the global symmetry. In the limit where I take G1 to zero, I have an exactly massless Goldstone boson, and so there can be no correction at all to the mass of the pi. You need both interactions, therefore, in order to see any divergence, and so there is indeed in this model a quadratic divergence of two loops, but nothing at one. Diagrammatically, the one-loop divergence cancels because while there is a quadratic divergence from the light gauge field, there's also one from the heavy gauge field, and they exactly cancel. So, like supersymmetry, we have partners canceling quadratic divergences, canceled by particles of the same statistics, and also like supersymmetry, the couplings that you need are guaranteed by symmetries. All right. So, this basic mechanism can be used to build fully realistic models that have the generic features, as I mentioned before, that its partners are the top, W and the Higgs, that cancel the quadratic divergences. But the important point is that the fields that cancel them can be relatively heavy. They can be as heavy as 2 TeV, in fact, as heavy as 4 or 5 TeV for the partners of the W and the Z. I don't have time to describe the realistic models in more detail, but let me just summarize the properties of these theories. So the Higgs is a pseudo-Goldstone boson that you can think of as being spat out from some ultraviolet strong dynamic strainer and protected by global symmetries. Okay? Unlike supersymmetry, the little Higgs is a special scalar. It's the lightest pseudo-Goldstone boson that survives. Okay? And there's a good reason why it doesn't come accompanied with many, many other friends. Okay? Remember, that was our initial problem with the supersymmetry in the little hierarchy. The partners of these guys with the same statistics cancel the quadratic divergences. They can be quite heavy and still natural. Electroweak symmetry breaking turns out to be triggered by the top-Yukawa coupling in very much the same way as in supersymmetry, in a calculable way. And interestingly, precision electroweak constraints are not trivially satisfied. They're parametrically okay. They're not trivially numerically okay everywhere, but there are large natural regions of parameter space where things are good. And there are UV completions of these theories at 10 to EV, going all the way up to M Planck, that are, some have been constructed. There's more work going on them. In a sense, this is the revival of the strong dynamics program for electroweak symmetry breaking, except there's just one last step at the end with this thing that was just a little unnaturally light that got spat out at the end. The strong dynamics we can't have at the TEV scale, but we can have it at 10 to EV, and that's where it is. And if something like this theory is realized in nature, this is a real motivation for building a DLHC. Okay? The really interesting physics here would be happening at 10 to EV and not at 1 to EV. A few things happen at 1 to EV, everything else happens at 10 to EV. There's natural dark matter candidates, again, for very similar reasons in supersymmetry. There's natural discrete symmetries. And in many versions of these models, it turns out, much like universal extra dimensions, as Joe was mentioning this morning, it's rather difficult to distinguish these theories from supersymmetry at hadron colliders. Okay, so those are two examples of theories that were sort of constructed with the little hierarchy problem in mind. And so far, the generic expectation is that things are a little heavy. Things are heavier than you thought. Of course, we can always forget this little hierarchy problem completely. And imagine that in 2008 in Geneva, at the ATLAS, zillions of events come out. And we discovered that it's the constrained MSSM at exactly 0.3 as studied by the ATLAS group. Some totally vanilla version of supersymmetry, and many people would be happy. That's still possible. You have to ignore the little hierarchy problem, but it's still possible. Or, continuing to ignore the little hierarchy problem, we could have Steve's famous smoking cannon. Okay, so we scatter things on a brain, we make a big black hole, they Hawking radiate, everything is lovely. While we're at it, at Washington, we'll see Newtonian gravity transition to one of art of the fourth at 50 microns. So this is all possible. But I want to emphasize that that we're ignoring the little hierarchy problem when we entertain these possibilities. But on the other hand, if we do take the little hierarchy problem seriously, in many of these theories, the new physics is heavier and harder to see than in our delirious with joy scenarios, making it even more important to beat down backgrounds and even more important to figure out exactly how we can do in disentangling this physics. So thank you very much.
Question? I guess I'm having a slight problem in understanding how you related the little hierarchy problem to supersymmetry in the following sense. Perhaps this is connected with the obvious comment that when you say that precision electroweak data tells you that lambda is between 5 and 10 TeV, of course that's with the assumption that there's a coefficient out in front which is of order unity. And had you made the same observation back in 1960, I guess you would have expected the weak interaction scale closer to a TeV rather than 100 GeV.
I was being a little sloppy.
Let me just finish.
Yeah.
So obviously the question is you have to know whether the coefficients are perturbative in size or order unity or pi even. But I want to just, I mean, that must be related to the following point, which is, I thought you were, the tension you were trying to find in the little hierarchy problem was that precision electroweak physics was putting severe constraints on the type of new physics. And that's where I have the problem with supersymmetry, because in my mind, supersymmetry is one of the most benign theories of new physics.
Only in the regions of parameters where it's not parametrically natural. This is the point.
Well, okay. Let me say two things on that. One is, I mean, you can ask yourself, for what values of supersymmetric masses do you get very little contributions to electroweak radiative corrections? And the answer, 200 to 300 GeV. If I put all the supersymmetry
That's
masses,
why it's important to ask the parametric question. I completely agree that you can fiddle around, but here's the point, okay?
Yeah.
If we could have naturally had a theory where the superpartners were a loop factor heavier than the Higgs, not to have the Higgs comparable in mass of the superpartners, but the standard model particles are loop factor heavier than the Higgs, everything would be fine. If the superpartners are at the same scale as the Higgs and the W and the Z and the top, okay, for example, there's absolutely no reason why the correction to the rho parameter should be small. You would expect an order one deviation from the standard model prediction for the rho parameter.
If you put everything at 100 GeV, that's
right. Right, but 100 GeV then means parametrically at the same scale as the top.
Right.
Right. So, in fact, if you build theories of supersymmetry, as Ann Nelson and others have done, where you don't even have the freedom to fine-tune for electroweak symmetry breaking, you see very clearly that you're in major trouble with precision electroweak data. Okay. So it's definitely problematic. So now we can numerically get away with it by making the stops a little heavy, but parametrically, if we now separate scales a lot and ask, in the limit where the Higgs and the W and the Z and the top and all the superpartners are at the same scale, should we expect the standard model to have given us the correct value for rho? The answer is no. In what limit do we get the standard model giving us the correct value of rho? When the superpartners are parametrically heavier than that. That would be the limit where everything is fine. The problem is, it's hard to make the Higgs parametrically lighter than the superpartners.
Yeah, I guess one final comment.
Yeah.
Is it
the reflection of all of that is just those plots, right? You know, anyone who's really tried to make electroweak symmetry breaking work, as you have, and in many models, supergravity, gauge mediation, any theory, it's hard. It's not easy. You typically run into 5%.
Okay, one last comment. At the end of the day, I mean, to solve this question, supersymmetry, I agree 100%. You will have to solve the problem of the origin of supersymmetry breaking, and that goes without saying. But the question is, at what scale do you solve that problem?
I think it goes beyond that, because the problem that we're having, the bottom-up problem that we're having now, has nothing to do with the origin of supersymmetry breaking. It now really has to do with just put the stops anywhere you want. Choose anything you want for the stops, choose anything you want for the A terms. Okay? And now just push things so that you get a big enough quartic coupling. You're still fighting the log against the quadratic divergence. It's a pure low-energy problem now. It has nothing to do with where these numbers came from. It just has to do with on the one hand making the physical Higgs heavy enough, on the other hand, and then buying it. Yeah. Okay.
One more question.
So in the 2.7 model that you showed us, all and all those partners are heavier or much.
No, everything gets heavier. The Higgs gets heavier, everything gets heavier.
Oh, the Higgs gets heavier.
The Higgs gets heavier. Now, I don't know exactly where. I'm just saying that there's a limit now where you can start making everything heavier. And now, of course, as you make them heavier, it's okay to make the Skorks heavier. Then the tuning just goes down.
So how heavy is the Higgs then?
I certainly don't know numerically. So parametrically, everything could be at the TeV scale. Okay. So parametrically, we're taking it to a limit now where the Higgs and the superpartners are on top of each other, but they're all more strongly coupled.
Okay. Because the gut scale became 4 orders of magnitude less than the previous gut scale.
Right.
So you should be running back, right? And you should be getting all your spectrum, you're saying, parametrically
So I don't know anything about the detailed spectrum, but I'm saying from the low energy point of view, the physical Higgs can be heavier now, and the Higgs and the superpartners can start getting closer to each other. The problem is, when the Higgs is light, we can't have the superpartners. If we could have the Higgs light and the superpartners heavy, everything would be great. The problem is, parametrically, we have the Higgs light and the superpartners light. That's bad. Okay. What this does is allow the Higgs and the superpartners to be equally heavy by making them all heavy. Okay.
But yeah. Am I wrong that to make the Higgs heavy, as you say, yeah, then you face the question why at LEP it looks light? So
absolutely,
you need a little,
yes,
conspiracy.
That's
there,
right,
too,
yeah, yeah,
and some fiddling and fine-tuning.
Sorry, are you talking about why...
Yeah, why at LEP... it looks like the Higgs is light.
That's because the same thing, at least the direction is correct. The same effect that allows the Higgs to become heavier simultaneously gives a positive contribution to the T parameter and allows you to move along the long axis of this ellipse.
Yeah,
so it's not a tuning. It's
Two kicks of the same order in general.
Sorry.
Two kicks of the same order in general add up to give the same order, not the cancellation. In other words,
we have a Yukawa coupling of the Higgs to a bunch to some vector-like fermions. These Yukawa couplings make positive contributions to the T parameter, and so we have two things. The Higgs gets heavier, so there's a negative contribution. There's a negative contribution to T from that. There's a positive contribution to T from these vector-like fermions. Of course, if you're really going to push things up to the TeV scale, really you're overshooting a lot and then overshooting a lot again. So it's hard to imagine why you'll end up in the ellipse. But I'm not advocating going all the way up to the TeV scale. Okay, so I'm saying that there's a direction where things get, yeah. But nothing is worked out explicitly. This is just a direction that I think one should go, which at least one could go, which might address the problem. But I, yeah.
Okay, let's thank Nima again.